Hello, good evening. Thank you and welcome to Insight Sessions with Health Practice Committee. Today we've got four speakers discussing what they do, what makes it sexy, what's been happening in the area, the big issues, opportunities for actuaries in the area. So to start off, we have Bronwyn. She's currently with Teachers Federation Health, previously from EY. Yep. And then we have Nicole Stransky from Deloitte, and she'll be talking a little bit about the Singaporean health system. And we got Kirsten Armstrong from previously PwC and now Three Rivers, talking about water health. And we have Hayden Bernal from FIAC, Health Insurance Regulator. So we're going to run We're going to run a bit of a panel, so each will talk for about 5 to 10 minutes, and we'll have questions at the end. When you do have questions, please speak into the microphone, because this is currently recorded for the web and posterity and web logs, etc. So we'll start off with Bronwyn.
Okay.
Oh, is that how we're doing? Okay, right. So what main areas do you work in and what makes it sexy?
Okay. Yes, so I had prepared something for this, luckily. And I've got five things that I think make my job sexy. So number one is my boss is not an actuary. For how many people in this room is that true? Well, not bad. Oh, almost half. Okay. I guess the good thing about that from my perspective is he gives me a fair bit of autonomy to do the actuarial stuff. He says, I don't really understand actuarial things, so you go and decide how best to do it. And the other advantage is that I can try things out on him before I go out to an insurer who might have sort of similar perspectives and non-actuarial backgrounds. And that's very handy to road test things. Number two is probably only about 10% of the work that my team and I do is purely technical number crunching type work. And I find that a pretty good ratio. And even that 10% is actually, I think, reasonably sexy, because this is an industry where the 10% we do is mainly forecasting work, and there's no PHI textbook that tells PHI actuaries how to do forecasting. There's a range of practice, and each actuary and insurer out there does things in quite different ways. And
but it is a really good online CPD course. Run by the Institute.
So we just built a model from scratch and played around with all sorts of things until it was starting to produce good results. So that was quite exciting, seeing the precision improve a bit over time. Number three is probably half my time I now don't spend behind my computer. That was a huge percentage in my previous job, but now I think it's down to 50-50, which I really enjoy. I'm talking to people, I'm testing ideas and thoughts. I'm talking to various other teams within FIAC. I'm talking to the top guys in FIAC and our board regularly. Talking to insurers and their boards. Which leads me into number four, which is most of the conversations I have outside FIAC are actually reasonably difficult, challenging conversations. Some people might not find that sexy, but I guess part of my job is to think critically about practice in the industry and insurers and appointed actuaries, and only focus on the points of difference and the points of conflict between what we would like to see and what we do see, and that makes conversations difficult and challenging and brings out conflicts, but from a personal perspective is great for great for my development. And number five is previously, in my previous job at the government actuary, nobody had ever heard of me, and I would go to an industry convention or an actuarial convention, and I'd slink into the back row and have a bit of a listen and zone out a bit. And now I go to an actuarial convention and I'm trying to do that, but someone says, "Oh, the regulator's here in the room. What do you think about all of this?" And I have to quickly form a view and say something. And then I leave the room, go outside to morning tea, and I used to grab a muffin and then pretend I had a very important text message to respond to and hide away in the corner. And now I get assaulted from all sides, people wanting to talk to me about the latest developments in the industry. So there's my five things.
That's sexy. That's great. I have hastily written my five things. But first, what I do, so I tend to work or provide advice in everything outside the private health insurance sector. Not that I don't do anything in private health insurance, but mainly I'm doing stuff more on the other sort of 90% of the health system. So roughly 70% of the health system is funded by the government, about 20% by you and I just out of pocket, and about 10% by the private health insurance system. So PHI is just part of the story. And I'm doing probably more work with the other parts of the story. So mainly I'm doing advice to government. What do I do that with? Well, again, looking at our health system, roughly half of what our health system delivers is hospitals. The next biggest chunk is probably doctors, and the next biggest chunk after that is probably medicine. So they're probably the areas that I sort of tend to do most work. I mean, examples of the sorts of things I've been involved in. At the moment, I'm helping New South Wales Health to allocate the state's budget to different local areas. So basically there's a new sort of funding model that's been brought into Australia's health system, which called is activity-based funding for hospitals, and they're struggling to sort of deal with this, you know, payment on the basis of actually what you do as against payment on the basis of last year's budget plus 3%. So this is a whole new paradigm. It's very exciting and it's also very scary. So I'm helping them with some of that. I did quite a bit of work with the Department of Health and Ageing in Canberra, sort of doing things like sort of costing the impact of big pricing reforms to the pricing of medicines on the PBS, and I've done quite a bit of work around workforce planning, so looking at future sort of health system demand and what the workforce we might actually need to help to meet that. So there's just a couple of examples. What makes it sexy? Same sort of thing. I get to work with non-actuaries a lot, so I get to talk in sort of, you know, non-technical language quite a lot, and I really quite enjoy that, and explain, you know, quite difficult technical concepts and results and information in a way that other people can use. So it's really kind of almost like strategic business advice, which is good fun. It matters, you know. sometimes when I used to do, you know, valuations in insurance or whatever else, I kind of could see a tenuous link between what I was doing and whether it mattered, and now I can see a very, very direct link between, you know, some of the advice that I'm involved in and how it matters. I did some work very recently on a funding model for prosthetic limbs in New South Wales, so it was really about how much the New South Wales government would fund for amputees and how much you know, people with different levels of sort of, you know, need, different amputees, etc., would be able to get funded for different prosthetic limbs and so on. It was really, really interesting project. Did a lot of consultation with real people to really understand their needs. And yeah, but you can very much see directly it really matters. There's a wealth of untapped information and data out there that just hasn't been touched. So that makes it really interesting as well. So lots of new insights all the time. Big numbers, you know, New South Wales health budget that's sort of involved in is like $15 billion, something ridiculous. You know, it's big numbers, it's good fun. And it's all pretty new, like, so, you know, really developing new techniques and analyses and stuff, which is good fun. So there's my sexy story.
That's not working up. It is?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. As Ben said, I'm focusing, I don't spend all my time on it by any means, but I'm focusing on the Singapore system this evening, and specifically the work that we do in our team for MediShield, which is the base level of hospital cover provided to provided in Singapore. So any Singapore citizen or resident that has health insurance will have this product as its base level and effectively can go and get riders from private insurers as well. It is... moving on to what is sexy about it, I guess the first thing is the international travel since it is Singapore, although as you can see I'm pretty confined to here right now. So actually Stuart Roger, who I work with, is on a plane to Singapore right now. And Ignatius Lee, who's another colleague I work with, is actually in Hong Kong on a different health-related project, but yeah, a lot of international focus there, so... That's the first sexy thing. I don't have a list of five things, but I guess some of the other... a lot of them are the same sort of thing. So definitely working with non-actuaries. And no actuaries in Singapore who we deal with, apart from sometimes liaising with some of the private insurers, because MediShield is the base level of cover and these extra layers of insurance are available from the private insurers. If there is a product design or a pricing change in the MediShield level and the private insurers are basically offering a bundled product, then it obviously affects their pricing, their design, their profitability. But other than that, it's all non-actuarial staff. And another thing that makes it really interesting is that... in terms of the client that, or the clients that we're dealing with, the Ministry of Health over there is who controls the pricing and the design of the product, and so we price the premiums. We have access to hospitalisation data in Singapore, not just for the insurance product, but all hospitalisations. We look after the pricing and the policy work and the design work on the one hand. And then on the other hand, we also work for the Central Provident Fund, which actually insures and manages the scheme. So for the Central Provident Fund, we're doing annual valuations and ALM studies and stress testing and monitoring sort of exercises. So one of the really interesting things about it is relationship management, I guess, and trying to... sometimes it's allaying the concerns of the Central Provident Fund when they've heard that the Ministry of Health is you know, thinking about introducing a new cover for a ridiculously low price and putting it into the product or something like that. So obviously we have our responsibilities to each client and just that interaction and being a third party or a fourth party if you count the insurers as well, a fifth party if you count the insurance regulator as well, makes it... Yeah, really interesting dynamic. And another, I'm not sure whether you'd call this a sexy thing, but an interesting thing about it is that obviously for the Ministry of Health, the staff that we work with there are ultimately accountable to the Health Minister. And we've been involved directly in meetings involving the Singaporean Health Minister. So obviously... extremely high profile and great to have that opportunity. But on at least a couple of occasions that I can think of, my colleagues and I would kind of read a story in the press one morning and think, oh, we haven't been told that by anyone in the ministry. Oh, that must be wrong. And sure enough, by the end of the day, an email will have come through saying, would you be able to look at the data and see if, you know, we can actually introduce that benefit for this price, because, you know, he may have mentioned it in a speech yesterday. So it's interesting to be part of that loop and to be part of something that covers, you know, more than 3.5 million people and... as Kirsten said, really matters. It's a very broad... It's part of the overall health policy in Singapore and really integrated within their whole health framework. So that's me.
Okay. Hi, I'm Bronwyn. I spent a lot of years at Ernst & Young as a consultant, and most of that time was to private health insurance. And about a year ago, I took the plunge and moved to a private health insurer. So we're kind of either the biggest of the smalls or the smallest of the bigs, depending on how you want to look at us. I think we're still deciding ourselves how we want to see ourselves going forward. I think we're changing from being the biggest of the smalls to trying to think of ourselves with the big guys. So it's interesting. I'm probably the most actuarial of these guys in terms of traditional stuff. Part of my job is the very unsexy assisting with pricing and reserving and filling in statutory returns. But I guess the stuff that I find more works disagreeing with me that it's unsexy.
Would you like to discuss the level of sexiness around that factor?
I guess it depends on what you're wearing when you do it.
So,
the microphone's over there.
So I guess some of the more interesting things that I've had both consulting and in my current role are where we get to be involved in the more strategic stuff. I think with your actuarial training and the insight that you have into the company, particularly through things like the FCR, you can actually add a lot of value to the business in making strategic decisions and helping them make the right choices. So with EY, I worked with Warwick on a number of the demutualisations and acquisitions, which I find is really interesting. It's always very stressful. There's always unreasonable things. You know, you're on the phone to a lawyer at 11 o'clock at night debating whether this word should be member or policyholder, or, you know, and what implications it has for the rest of the, you know, 400 pages in the explanatory memorandum. But it's really, it is interesting, and it is really satisfying when it works and at the end of the project. Since I've moved to teachers, it's been amazing because I guess I have a very different skill set to anybody else there. I've been asked to do completely random things, from running a strategy session for the eye care centre, helping them focus on what brands of eyewear they want to sell in their shops and how they can limit the number of suppliers they deal with, you know, without pissing off any of the optometrists who all have their favourites. And, you know, mediating stuff like that has been really interesting and something also quite different. So, you know, I guess you're only sort of limited by how you limit yourself and that thing. A health insurer has a lot of data. My experience is most of them use a certain amount of it relatively well, but there's a whole lot of it that they don't use at all or use really badly. So one of the things we've been doing is helping get the data better and the usage of data more widespread in our company. It was really interesting at our strategic retreat that one of the things that company assessed themselves as doing best last year was creating a data warehouse and making it more accessible. And one of the things they all voted more money should be spent on was keeping doing it. And I'm like, wow, you've got the head of marketing saying, I want money spent on data. And you're sort of thinking, it's kind of unusual. It's, you know, but I guess it's sort of good that you can see that you're making a difference and that people are getting value out of having you there, which is nice. I guess the other thing I love about working for a company like I do is that it's very flexible. So my company in particular, one of the reasons that I'm there is that they are completely flexible about my hours, I have small children. You know, if I say there's cross-country carnival tomorrow, they're like, oh, so you're working from home? You know, and that's just accepted, it's normal, it's fine, and that's really good. So for me, where I am in my life, that's fantastic.
I'm not sure it's sexy, though. I'm sorry.
If you ask my kids, they would think it was. to all the people who are, like, under 30, you probably think I don't really care. But I guess that's one of the things that's really good for me. But I guess what's sexy for me is actually being part of the decision-making process in a company and helping guide its direction and having a say on where we go. And I like having a say, so it suits me. So there you go.
Any comments or questions before we move on to the next A lot of questions? No?
What is the next one?
Well, then, given that given we're going to...
Kirsten, health is roughly 9% of GDP.
So yes. Arguably 9 to 11, yes.
I'm passing to Kirsten now. So, yeah, it's a substantial industry. It's Australia's biggest industry. There's immense opportunities to contribute.
I think it is second, yeah. It depends on how you define the industry, but it is first or second. Yeah, absolutely. It's huge, and there's a huge amount of opportunity. I think because actuaries have tended to come from an insurance background, and because Australia only has sort of a small amount of health insurance relative to the overall size of the health system, then actuaries haven't been involved so much. But I am observing a growing number of people getting involved and a growing interest from both system managers, health providers, through to health funders and policymakers to actually engage the expertise of actuaries to help them along the way. So I think it's a lot of opportunity, and it's definitely starting to grow.
And risk really hasn't been a part of the health background, has it? Financial risk so much. But now, with sort of fixed funding starting to come on the scene, it is starting to become more so now. So the opportunities are there for people like us.
It's funny, we were discussing the risk issue, Ben and I were discussing the risk issue before, and I said, actually, I think the Institute has defined itself too narrowly as being about risk, and actually should go back to before, when we used to define ourselves about allocating scarce resources, i.e. intergenerational equity, allocating monies to shareholders, policyholders, all that sort of stuff. And actually the skills that we have in that area are actually extraordinarily and very directly day-to-day relevant to what health has to do and the system managers have to do. So if you add that into the mix as well as risk, then I think it's a clear value add.
I guess that's coming to our next sort of questions, but before that, we'll jump to Peter quickly.
I just had a question. Is this working?
Yep.
I had a question. Most of you work with non-actuaries. How do you feel they think about actuaries?
Sexy, it was obvious.
Apart from the sexy things you do, do they think that, do they think you add value?
It's on.
I have the interesting situation of... prior to me arriving at FIAC, there was basically one actuarial resource there, and we now have a team of three. So the amount and type of work that we've been able to do since then has changed quite dramatically from the perspective of management and the board. I think when I arrived on day one and we were planning out what we could do... when I arrived on day one, there was no work coming to us. There was maybe you can do this project, do a bit of modelling or one or two things. Now... just about every day a new piece of work comes to me or comes to us, and I have to often say no, and our sort of waiting list of projects is getting longer and longer and longer. So I find that really encouraging that the organisation's finding what we do to be valuable. And I think the more they see of us, the broader they see the set of problems that we can offer an opinion on. So that's encouraging.
Yeah, I'd say similar. Since I've been there, my workload just increases nearly on a daily basis. And so people say, can you do this? And I'm like, not this week. Now I'm saying, not this month. It just builds up. There are so many things that we can do. But... we also, I guess we never had an actuary where we are before, but even some of the other insurers who don't have actuaries, so some of the smaller ones, are now talking to us and going, do you think we're big enough to have our own actuary? What would it cost us? How can we get someone part-time? What do we do? So, I've got a phone call scheduled on Friday for one of the other insurers who's looking at getting an internal resource. So it's, it is being seen that we are adding value. In private health insurance is helped because there's the statutory appointed actuary role. So, you know, every private health insurer has to deal with an actuary in some way, shape or form. But it is really good when, you know, the board feedback is that, you know, you're ranked one of the top presenters they've had in the last year, you know, in terms of providing them useful information and being valuable. So it's...
Well, supplementary question. What is it they like about actuaries? That they, you know, you start off with no job at all and then you end up getting overwhelmed with work.
Can you repeat the question just for the mic?
The question from Peter was, what is it that they like about actuaries?
Can I give a quick example?
Yes.
I was in a meeting recently with New South Wales Health where there was a lot of people sitting around debating what the impact might be of making XYZ decision about the funding model. Very quickly we sort of said, you know, like, we can come to you with an answer tomorrow based on a tool that we've already developed to help actually analyse some of these issues. So let's talk about the scenarios and issues, but let's not sort of, you know, have a discussion that says, oh, this could happen and this could happen. Let's actually have some facts in front of us. And they were just so excited to have someone who could actually put some facts in front of them that actually went with the scenarios and issues that they were considering. Because there's a lot of, you know, people who just talk about the issues, oh, this could happen, but never actually put a number or a fact or a result or a forecast to it. And so that's more than anything, it's helping to really inform the decision-making.
I think it's also one of those things, it's the individual. Like in anything, it's what skills you have, how well you communicate to the people you're dealing with, you know, what you bring to the table. And if you can sell what you do, you know, the actuarial training is unbelievably useful in the way it helps you think about things and the way it helps you analyse things, but then you have to be able to translate that so it's useful to the people you're dealing with. And I think my time at EY Consulting helps you deal with that because you're dealing with different clients with different levels of sophistication all the time. So you're always having to translate. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that helps make people useful too.
Okay, I think we'll probably move on to the next two questions, which I'll combine to one, given that we're running out of time a little bit. So what's happening in your sector now? What are the big issues? And what are the opportunities for actuaries? You know, how do you get involved and what next? So maybe Nicole, have a go.
So probably the biggest issue that's facing Singapore's, maybe the biggest issue facing Australia as well, so the ageing and funding, ageing not only health costs but costs in general. How is Singapore addressing it? Well, in a number of ways, and it is very different to Australia, and it's good to have that perspective. So in terms of health costs, in terms of our involvement in MediShield and how we get involved ourselves, Singapore has a medical savings account, so every working Singaporean is contributing somewhere between 6 and 9% of their income into an account which can then be used for health costs or approved health insurance products, which obviously includes their MediShield premium. That's one aspect where they're looking for self-funding and sustainability in their system. We are repricing the scheme at the moment, and they're wanting to extend cover, which currently goes till age 85 up to age 90. There's obviously a huge unknown about the health costs at that age, and one of the issues that's come up is can we arrange for some sort of extra payment into everyone's MediSave account just to make sure that they keep their MediShield cover, and therefore, you know, we're providing the right incentives and the right risk pooling and keeping the risk pool broad and keeping the premiums affordable. And, you know, is this in turn addressing our broader objectives around ageing costs and how to deal with the longevity of our population? In conjunction with MediShield itself, there's also a long-term care scheme, ElderShield, that operates in Singapore. And there's been questions come up recently as to the adequacy of that. So it's designed to directly fund the needs of people based on their ability to look after themselves. And an issue that's come up is, can it somehow be rolled into MediShield? Should it all be held under one scheme, under one fund? Would that better address the objectives of also the issues around ageing health costs as well? So that's just a couple of aspects there, but it's a big issue. It's a big issue everywhere, and Singapore deals with it in quite a unique and different way, which kind of adds insight when you then look back at what's happening and not happening in Australia.
Okay. Emerging...
Billy shoes.
Okay. Yep. So I can actually give you a bit of a scoop tonight. The long-awaited capital standards for private health insurance are gathering some momentum, and we're hopeful that we might have a discussion paper out in the near future.
This year?
Potentially this financial year, maybe. And that it needs to go through council, and ultimately our council, they'll ultimately decide what form it takes. But management is proposing that we move away in the direction of more principles-based standards, away from rules-based, and that will create opportunities for actuaries. I think actuaries will be called on by insurers to assist them with the changes and assist them with the calculations that go along with a more principles-based regime.
What are opportunities for actuaries going forward, do you think? Will that create more work for appointed actuaries? Or?
Yeah, so I expect there'll be a fair bit of transitional work in getting... That actuaries will probably advise insurers around getting their heads around the new standards, and perhaps a little more ongoing work as well, as calculations get redone each year, or the methods or assumptions get revisited.
Just before we move on to Bro, I noticed that in the budget just recently announced the creation of a new premium and competition unit. Is that going to create more opportunities or agony for actuaries in the future?
It's yet to be decided how we'll exactly use those resources, and also who those resources will be. But it may be that we take on one more actuary, for example, as part of that new initiative. There's the premiums part and the competition part. Premiums might... most insurers and actuaries tell us that there's plenty of room for improvement in the analysis work that we do around pricing, so there's another resource or two there for that. So that we, yep. And competition is something which... I recently visited all the appointed actuaries and asked most of them what they think about the level of competition in private health insurance, and I got 12 totally different answers. I think it's an area that hasn't been well studied in private health insurance, and it'll be quite interesting to see what that new work drags up.
What do you think will achieve? The competition part.
The competition part? Well, what does competition normally achieve? I mean, I imagine there'll be studies around trying to measure the level of competition, and there'll be thinking around potential ways of improving competition, and improved competition would be good for consumers.
More innovation.
Potentially, yes.
More products.
It could mean less products. Who knows, David?
Do you think that the competition unit might recommend that there be less prescription, for instance, in private health insurance products, which would enable a more competitive framework?
potentially.
That's right. So I guess I'd like to add to Hayden in private health insurance. One of the big items at the moment is the means testing of the rebate. Most health insurers are fairly uncertain about what that's going to mean for them, depending on their membership. Health insurers don't collect a lot of information on their members in terms of salary and stats, apart from date of birth and sex, because you're not allowed to risk rate health insurance, so there's no need for that information, so we never obtain it. Other things that the industry is still, this is, I guess, controversial, but a lot of people still believe the industry will be subject to more consolidation over the future. So there are opportunities for actuaries in that, particularly if funds demutualise when they get taken over. You know, the share allocation rules and all sorts of things, which is getting back to our equity discussion, to be looked at. We've had the first new private health insurer in quite a long time just start recently, so that's something which, while it's tiny at the moment and will take a while to grow, you know, the industry is watching. Warwick's shaking his head, it's not tiny, it's already doing fabulously. So...
yeah, quite a while.
So there's always stuff happening. Sovereign risk in private health insurance in Australia is huge. So whenever there's a change of government, whenever there's a change of policy, because the government spends so much money on health, and they spend quite a lot of money on private health insurance, particularly through the rebate, they're very interested in us, and there's a lot of things they can do to change. The government is very keen on us doing a lot more things in the broader health cover space, so hospital in the home, rehabilitation out of a hospital setting, preventative programs, disease management, and a lot of health insurers are still getting their heads around how that works and how they can justify it. Some of it's eligible for risk equalisation. For those of you who know a bit more about private health insurance, there's a risk pooling scheme for high cost claimants. Some of not. There's all sorts of weird and wonderful rules that make it difficult to do some of these broader health cover initiatives, but every time we talk to the government, to the Department of Health and Ageing, they're saying, what are you doing in this space? Why aren't you doing more? When are you going to be doing more? And I know for us, we think we're doing pretty well for our size. And, you know, there are a lot of things happening in the space there. So there will be a lot of things, and evaluating these programs is a big thing at the moment. You know, how do you evaluate them? Globally, people find it really hard to evaluate a lot of health initiatives. There's potential clinical outcomes, there's financial outcomes, there's just member feeling loved outcomes. How you balance all of those as a health insurer to decide whether it's worthwhile or not is a complicated decision, and it's something where actuaries have a big role to play. I think there's lots of roles for actuaries in health insurers. The big health insurers all have an actuarial team and an analytics team, and a lot of them are growing. A lot more of the smaller health insurers are looking at having someone in-house, whether that's full-time or part-time. So there's a couple of us here. So, you know, and there's always...
Do you think there will be, you know, 50-plus, 100-plus health actuaries in the next 20 years?
In private health insurance? Yeah. Peter calling out absolutely from the back.
We had this conversation 20 years ago when there was zero. And how many are there now? 40? 50? And I think probably, I mean, there's 12 appointed actuaries. Most of the big funds have got 4 or 5 actuaries. There's a whole lot of consultants in the field that are. And there's the wider field.
I do, but in private health insurance, I do think there is a limit, because there are only so many health insurers. If they consolidate,
well, perhaps there is.
There's
but
even fewer, but...
We know in year, yeah. Every health fund I know that's hired an actuarial student has had exactly the experience that you guys have described. You know, that is, they don't know what they're going to do with it. You know, at the time they hire them, they, sort of, they feel they're taking a big risk, and... 12 months down, they say to me, we're really worried that she'll leave. Because we're so dependent on her now. And she's got so much corporate knowledge. And I say, well, get another one. and that's the process. So I think that still hasn't yet matured.
What about you, Kirsten? What do you think about the future and health, wider health? You know, how look,
I think
in that space.
I think there's a lot of opportunity. There's two big drivers that are behind that. One of those is e-health. So e-health means that a lot more information is going to be collected and available about, you know, for each and every one of us when we go to the GP, when we go to the hospital, whatever. That's all going to be linked up. So that we'll each have an individual electronic health record that we can actually track our health history, and researchers can do that as well, and that means actuaries as well can actually look at longitudinal data around individuals, which I think is really, really valuable in thinking about things like evaluating cost-benefit analyses, all these sorts of things. That's really going to start to build a really critical database to do that. National health reforms is the other really huge one, which is about activity-based funding for our hospitals. More than anything, it's two things. One is activity-based funding for our hospitals. The other is about the Commonwealth actually being on risk and being clearly on risk for growth in hospital costs and growth in hospital activity, which they haven't been before. And actually, that gives the Commonwealth an opportunity to start to invest in prevention to minimise hospital costs, which they haven't had before. Department of Health in Canberra hasn't been able to have that argument with Department of Treasury in Canberra because they've never been on risk until now. But the activity-based funding is a critical one, because what it means is that there's going to be a lot better quality data about what our hospitals do. There's going to be a lot better data about what those activities cost, and a lot better data about the performance of those hospitals. And it's no surprise that there's an actuary who's the deputy chair of the National Hospital Performance Authority. So that's John Walsh, and so that's a real clear sign that there's a role for actuaries in this sort of whole issue around costing, pricing, performance monitoring of hospitals. Just one quick comment for about one of the sort of side effects that I think is going to come out of activity-based funding is that there's going to be a lot of unravelling of cross-subsidies, et cetera, across the public hospital system, and I think that's going to have a flow-on impact for the private health insurance system, which you need to be cognizant of. so at the moment, in New South Wales, for example, 17% of public hospital activity separations is for private patients. That's kind of quirky, that is subsidised by both. That's a word you could use by both the state and Commonwealth governments. So basically, the bed day rate that's paid for a private patient going into a public hospital is less than you might pay if you went into a private hospital, because it's capped by the Commonwealth government. So all these sorts of issues are kind of coming out into the open, and everyone's sort of asking questions, well, who should really be paying for this? Similarly with things like fully compensable patients, so Motor Accidents Authority, et cetera, they're having a look at actually, are we recovering 100% of the cost for these? Because, you know, now that we know we're activity-based funding, we're only going to get this much money from the state government for all activity, our ability as a hospital to cross-subsidise different components is sort of starting to unravel, and we really need to understand our costs and our prices a lot better. So there's going to be a lot of that happening over the next few years, and I think they're sort of discovering, actually, that there's a lot of kind of scary stuff kind of under the carpet. So I expect to see a lot of change happening over the next few years.
And they are promising that they will make that data available to, you know, private health insurers, and we've talked to them from that perspective, because it will also impact general insurers, all those sorts of things. So it will have huge flow-on effects to the private insurance industry, and they are saying that they will make that data available. It will probably affect hospital contracting for health insurers, because there will be government standards out there about what rates are being paid for what service in what hospital.
Kirsten, what about the public sector? What about Medicare and the PBS? Drug evaluation. Three areas: Medicare, the PBS, and the TGA that evaluates drugs, the Therapeutic Goods Administration. As from my observation, right on the edges and fringes of these, they have no actuaries involved at all, and they have basically very little quantitative skill employed.
Look, I think that I probably disagree with you on the PBS side of things, and largely because there is to be honest, like that's where a lot of the rigour around health economic analysis and health economic sort of cost-benefit analysis actually came from. And there is a whole school of thought and academic rigour around actually doing those analyses. I think there's probably a bigger picture policy issue about whether we are prepared to pay for prevention stuff and therefore stuff that will have an impact down a lot further down the track versus saving a life. And I think that's probably the biggest issue I see for the PBS is actually that their discount rate, so to speak, is extraordinarily large. You know, they're not prepared to pay for stuff that might happen well into the future, which is why their focus has been more on, saving the life, the cancer drug, versus preventative medications. Anyway, that's a bit of an aside. But the issue around the MBS, I think there has been, in my view, a real lack of research and rigour around a lot of that. I think that the hospital reforms will actually start to inform that. So a lot of the there are organisations out there who I was talking to an organisation called the Capital Markets CRC, who actually have done a lot of work to actually map the Medicare procedures and codes to DRG's hospital codes. And so if you can get a price for this one that everyone's comfortable with, you can guarantee Medicare, or should, and hopefully will be, looking at updating their information and prices a lot more rigorously, because they really don't. There's not a lot of rigour around pricing and very little rigour, I think, around performance and actually even thinking about appropriate allocation of resources is just not there. So I think that's an area where there's a lot of work to do.
Any questions and general comments?
Nicole, I think there's a massive opportunity for work in private health insurance in Asia, and I have practical evidence of that in my current role. So what's happening in Asia is that really rich people never needed insurance in the past, and really poor people couldn't afford insurance. But what's happening in Asia is that we're getting the middle class coming through in all sorts of countries, and these people need insurance. And if you actually look at people who have experience in private health insurance, in the sort of tripartite nature of this insurance and the importance of contracting and providers, then there are very few people in Asia who really have that. So people in Australia who've got that experience, in my experience, are very will be very valuable, and this will be a very strongly growing market for all of us.
Okay, thanks. I totally agree with that. And just to add from a kind of different aspect to what Kirsten and Bronwyn have been talking about, I think that a lot of there is a lack of skills in that. I mean, just the fact that we are the actuarial advisors in Singapore, I guess, points towards something. But a lot of the issues that we are asked about and that we work on, we really have to go back to first principles. We're problem solving, we're looking at risk, we're looking at the allocation of scarce resources, and it's the very fundamental actuarial type problem solving without necessarily being the traditional pricing valuation, etc., etc. And that sort of thinking and that sort of knowledge and skill base is globally transferable. And therefore, I think that, there's a huge opportunity for actuaries to be a really big part of that knowledge sharing and, for us to be bringing thought leadership back to the Australian environment, which we have, Deloitte does do on a regular basis. We last year or the year before, actually, a big team from the Ministry of Health came out here to go around and talk to insurers here about what's happening and feedback and interaction with them, getting back to the problem solving aspects and the very fundamental kind of risk analysis that actuaries are experts in, I think makes us an important part of this global kind of progress, if it is going to be progress, around health costs, ageing costs, and addressing some of those really huge issues. So there's actuarial opportunity there for sure.
Cool. Any more questions? If not, I think we might wrap up and thank the speakers so that you can have more mingling and drinking time and get sexy with it. So just put your hands together with me to thank the speakers. Thank you.
Sort of make a final comment. The Institute has health financing and management principles that are on its website. Those principles, I think, are worth looking at. And I think it would also be good from an Institute perspective if we did something more with those principles. To develop the profile of actuaries. So it's one of the few public policy areas where we have principles on the website which, by and large, have not been criticised. The other area... But the other area... And they are very controversial, hot... You know, I think there are some hot issues there that where the Institute has stood up for, these policy principles.
Thank you.
Very much the health practice committee kind of wanting to find out who was doing stuff in health and get everyone to meet everyone. So you are very, very strongly encouraged to stay for a drink. You don't have to get sexy with it. It's fine.